Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for High Velocity Radio.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. Stone Payton, Lee Cantor here with you this afternoon. Lee, this is our Marketing Superheroes series. This is going to be a fun segment. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast CMO and Head of Business Development for Champion Capital Group and Startup Nation 2 Enterprise, Mr. Steve Cook. How are you, man?
I'm great. Thanks, Stone. Thanks, Lee.
Well, Steve, we were excited about doing this series, Marketing Superheroes, and we were doing some episodes, and one of the guests, we asked them, who are the thought leaders that they pay attention to, and your name came up pretty quickly. So congratulations on that. I know you've been doing some work on that Adobe site, the CMO.com site. Can you talk a little bit about kind of your background and what makes you such a superhero in the eyes of so many chief marketing officers out there?
Well, I'll come at this very humbly because I am humble. My background is 30 years of working at three Fortune 50 companies, starting my career at Procter & Gamble, working globally in brand marketing and innovation, coming to Atlanta to work at Coca-Cola for 13 years in global brand marketing, starting the first global innovation group, and then working with large billion-dollar customers around the world, and then working at Samsung Electronics to be the CMO for U.S., Canada, and Mexico across all product lines. But 7 years ago, when I left Samsung, I left in 2008. If you go back to that time period, a lot's happened in the last 10 years. The iPhone first generation was introduced, and here we are getting ready for the 10th anniversary edition to come out. Twitter was launched, LinkedIn took off, Facebook took off, and it was easier for people that have identified a problem and come up with a solution to start a company. And so I initially started working as an outsourced chief marketing officer to help technology startups with everything that they needed from a marketing and a business development standpoint.
So then when you got to see a front row seat on how the big corporations do marketing, and then now you're working with more of the startups, and how is that different in your mind? Or, I mean, is marketing? It doesn't matter if you're a global company or you're a startup.
Well, let me just ladder up for a second here. What we've seen emerging, both with Fortune 1000 companies and also with entrepreneurs, is in the last decade, both of those groups have realized how much they need each other. But they both look at the world very differently, and they both have capabilities and mindsets and other variables that enable them to do what they do, but they both need each other. And this is what I would call the enterprise to entrepreneur issue that is happening right now. And because I've worked in both areas, and believe me, it was a learning curve for me to learn the entrepreneurial space and how to do marketing on a shoestring budget, how to do business development on a shoestring budget versus working in a large company where you have more access to capital. I've been the in-between introducing Fortune 1000s to entrepreneurs that have relevant innovations, and entrepreneurs to Fortune 1000s where their innovations could be relevant to the Fortune 1000 business model. So this is a huge area. It was a big topic at South by Southwest Interactive this past March, and Beth Comstock, the COO of General Electric, and Steve Case, the founder of AOL, and now he has his own VC firm called Revolution. They gave a panel discussion to about 600 people on this very topic.
Now, it seems like you're uniquely positioned to be able to be that kind of conduit between those two groups because of your experience. But in terms of marketing as a practice and a line of work, is that something that is marketing the same? Are the tenets and philosophies the same for a Fortune 100 company and an entrepreneur? Like, are there some core things that are the same? It doesn't matter. One group might have more resources, but are the tenets the same?
Yeah, that great question, Lee. And the simple answer is yes. But there are different constraints that an early stage company has, generally capabilities, time, and capital. And those constraints force a startup team to still go through the basics, but to do them at startup speed and do it in the absolute leanest way possible. So let me give you an example. One of the things that I do with every technology company startup that I work with is I work with founding teams, and not surprisingly, most founding technology companies, the founding members have technical backgrounds.
Sure.
They're engineers, they're operators, they have vertical experience, in the verticals that they're solving. And they believe they have identified a problem that is scalable and monetizable and where they have unique IP. And they may have found that or they may not have. But what I find more times than not is that they have difficulty in narrowing down what the problem is that they're solving. They have difficulty in saying in a very succinct way, what is the solution we've created that solves that problem? They get caught up in the technology. They fall in love with what they've developed, and that's fine. But when you're talking to a VC or talking to a prospect, if you start talking about the wonderful code you've written, they really don't care. They want to know what problem that I have or pain point that I have, are you solving? What's your solution? Why are you different, better, and special than other options that I have? And so that is a dynamic that any company of any size in any vertical clearly needs to create. What are the problems we're solving? What's the solution? How are we different, better, and special? And then all the other marketing and biz dev issues. How do we go to market? Who is our target prospect? What are the prioritizations? What is our ideal prospect? These are all things that a startup still needs to do, but you have to do them faster. Right. You don't have the time. You don't have the capital. You don't have luxury of having team members. So you've got to really find ways to do it smart but fast.
Now, how have you seen the role of marketing evolve, especially in terms of their alignment with sales? It seems now with technology, there's a better chance of them working together, where maybe historically and maybe when you started, those were two kind of siloed areas and they each had their own objectives and they were each going about it in their own manner. And they weren't as collaborative as maybe technology allows them to be today.
Yeah, excellent point. And I've been in this business for over 30 years. I've always believed that there should be 100% overlap between marketing and sales. They need to work as a team, not as just colleagues and occasionally bump into each other in the hallway. They need to be 100% aligned. So I've always operated that way, and I enjoy business development and have some natural abilities there. So that may be one reason why I had an affinity for biz dev. But in today's world, and this has been building for the last decade or so, marketing and business development have been coming together. And I've seen quite a few companies create new jobs and new titles and new roles that fall under the banner chief revenue officer. So that's somebody that not only has business development / revenue responsibility, but also has the responsibility that they would have had as a CMO. And, it depends on the company situation, but I think that is one way to make sure there's alignment, have the buck stop with one person. But there are a lot of different software suites out there that help marketers provide more precise information to their sales counterparts. Once they talk about who are we trying to get, and you can, demand creation software, content marketing initiatives can drive leads, qualified leads to the sales team. So there are a lot of software suites out there that help marketing and sales teams come together. But I think at the end of the day, it's more of a mindset than it is a capability or an org chart. Salespeople and marketing people need to understand what the other group does, find overlap, talk to each other beforehand, and present a united front to the rest of the C-suite, and go to market in a united way, doing what you each need to do, but doing it in a united way. We live in a world now where almost irregardless of the B2B or B2C vertical you're in, the consumer is driving the dialogue. And if there is information out on the web that the sales team's created and then separately the marketing team's created and they don't align, your buyer, your prospect is going to see that, and you're going to look like you're not together, and therefore they probably won't buy from you.
And especially as you mentioned, in a startup, you don't have the luxury of the resource and the time to kind of be siloed. You better be working together because you're on the same team and you got to get this thing to work as quickly as possible.
Absolutely.
So, Steve, what trends are you seeing in marketing?
Well, we've all heard a lot about the Internet of Things, and I just read something the other day that by 2030, researchers are forecasting that each of us will have 19 connected devices that are identified with us, which is quite amazing. But what all of those IoT devices do is they throw off data. So what marketers are trying to figure out now is how do you capture that data? How do you make sense of it? And how do you use it predictively to drive your sales, drive your CRM with your consumer? So that is a big area. Another trend, which is a key focus of Adobe's, is how to become an experience business. Adobe's mantra is we're living in an experience era, and therefore every business really needs to figure out how to become an experience business. And here's why that's important. In almost every category, there are at least two competitors, possibly more, that have enough similarities across every available price, product features, warranty, et cetera, et cetera. And so how do you differentiate yourself? A big way to do that is the way that a consumer experiences your brand or your service, both online and offline. Are you dealing with me in a way that is personalized, in a way that recognizes that I've been a consumer of your product for a long time and you value that and you know what I bought? Or every time I come to your site, do you treat me like somebody that's never been on your site before? These things matter. And you think about any brand that you interact with, from an airline to a retailer, the way that you are treated is an important reason to continue to do business with that company. So those are two huge trends marketers are dealing with.
Now, how does a company do kind of human at scale?
Well, I think, you know, when we have artificial intelligence and bots, we are all going to be interacting with bots that sound human. I mean, we're dealing with that today, but that's going to become more prevalent, and they will know us possibly better than a human being will. So I think we're going to have virtual human interactions that will do the job for us. How do you scale real human beings? I don't know the answer to that, because you know there's always labor costs, and we continue to see companies shedding their workforce and either outsourcing it or automating it. So I don't know that you can scale human beings, but I think the challenge is, how do you create a human-like experience that is more than just acceptable?
And that you think that's possible?
I do. I don't know how to do it technically, but I'm not an engineer. But
right.
I mean, think about Alexa is interacting. The servers are interacting with millions of people. But when when Lee talks to his Alexa and says, you know, Alexa, can you do this for me? She says, yes, Lee, I will do that. Do you want the same product you ordered the last time? So computing power is there. I think what we've got to figure out is how do we continue to make it more human-like so that it becomes acceptable to us that we're not dealing with a human being for everything that we deal with. I think it will be important to continue to have the option to hit 000 on your phone when you keep going through a computer do loop and talk to a human being. I don't think businesses can eliminate a human interaction entirely, but I think human-like interactions can be automated with smart technology.
Right. I mean, with the computing power getting increasing so rapidly, and people having more and more of these devices, it's getting better and better. I mean, we're obviously at infancy of this technology, and there's gonna be more of it, not less of it, moving forward. Now, it's some of what we get nowadays, or marketers have access to nowadays, are metrics. And part of the chief marketing officer's job is to discern, you know, the metrics from the cosmetrics, we like to say, where just because you can get a number doesn't mean it's really the number that's important. How do you help companies kind of identify what numbers are the most important that they should be paying attention to? What metrics should they be following? And how do you help them in that area? Because there is so much data available nowadays. How do you determine what is the relevant data and what is kind of not as relevant?
That's a great question, and it's a pretty difficult task to figure out which two or three metrics matter. And I remember being in an audience in Palo Alto where a successful startup CEO in Palo Alto basically gave his keynote saying his company is one metric, and I can't remember what that was, and it was a B2B service provider, but they had one metric. And he said, the fewer metrics you have, the more focused your team will be. If you have a lot of metrics, you're going to be chasing a lot of things. So every business is different. I mean, clearly, for any business that is not a not-for-profit, revenue has to be one or two. It should be one. But there may be early indicator metrics, such as qualified leads that we're getting through various means, and you know how fast we're moving people through the business development funnel. But revenue is very important. And on a tangent, since we're talking about marketing and CMOs' work, CMOs, and again, this has been building for several years, but CMOs and all marketers need to own revenue generation. There's no way they can escape that anymore. In the old days, that was the sales job or the business development person's job. But marketers need to be accountable for impacting revenue, and their feet need to be held to the fire. Those days are here.
So now, when you're working with a firm and maybe at the beginning of one of your contracts with them, or you're starting with them, how do you help them identify the metrics that matter? And how do you help kind of create the environment that your marketing can be tied to revenue and that you can be held accountable for your work?
Well, with startup teams, again, you're dealing with small teams, you know, in close proximity most of the time to each other. So it's very easy to have those conversations in real time. I can't give you a pat answer about how I go through the process, because it's different with each company, and I come into companies in different stages where...
Well, then maybe can you share a story, a success story that you helped a company? Maybe they were a little off track and you helped them kind of get their bearings. Sure. And then aim correctly. I mean, you don't have to name the name of the company, but...
I'll actually give you a direct reference. So you mentioned earlier that I'm the CMO for Startup Nation to Enterprise, which is essentially a tech transfer office in Israel that represents 45 colleges and research labs across Israel. And they incubate innovation, they patent innovations that make sense, and I help them do marketing and business development in the United States. And one of the things that I've been working with their board and their CEO on is to help them understand the business development funnel with Fortune 1000 companies, because that's who we are going to with IP that would be relevant for that Fortune 1000 company. And even though I'm dealing with smart people in Israel, you know, many of them have thought, and some still do, unfortunately, that, you know, once that IP and the patent is granted, that all you need to do is call up the right person at a Fortune 1000 company and a deal is going to be done in several months. life doesn't work that way. Human beings go through stages of becoming aware of a company and a product, forming interest, getting engaged where you're actually considering that company as a viable product, and then moving closer to the sale where you're actually doing proof of concept, and then some form of transaction happens, again, either for proof of concept or for broader usage. So developing metrics and being able to show and track the stages that our business development work is at with different prospects has been a metric that has helped people who don't have business development backgrounds understand the strategic selling stages that, by and large, every buyer has to go through and does go through.
Now,
versus sending them an email with a PowerPoint.
And with a buy now button. It's more complex than that, and there's multiple
people. It doesn't work that way. Yeah.
Right. There's also, how do you help them when there is such complexity? When you're trying to sell to an enterprise, there could be 10 people in different departments that are going to have to touch this or sign off on something related to it. How do you kind of keep all those ducks in a row?
So what I've been doing, I wouldn't call this a metric. I would call it more of a process. And it's something that I've adapted from strategic and conceptual selling processes that we used at Coca-Cola. I've had to streamline them. Again, we don't have time and money to craft a strategic selling plan that would take several weeks at Coke. I've got to get it done in an afternoon. But I use that as a way to track progress and to explain to the rest of the C-suite who the different types of buyers are in the room, what their roles are, where they will come in and come out of conversations, and who has the ultimate economic buying decision, which is generally one person in almost every case. One person has the power to say yes and put money against a decision. Everybody else is either an influencer buyer, a user buyer, or a technical buyer, or an internal coach, which can be any of those people. And so I've used that process and that selling technology to help educate people who don't have a business development background the complexities of selling a business-to-business intellectual property product to very complex matrixed Fortune 1000 companies. And it's a teaching process and a learning process. And I don't have everybody at the level that I would hope they would be at. So this is one of the things I do. I teach people disciplines they're not familiar with, but that they need to know in order to have a successful company at the end of the day.
Well, I think one of the biggest contributions would be just opening their mind to how this looks. You know, they think it may look like one thing and you're explaining, hey, imagine an org chart and this person has this role, this person has this role. These eight people are going to touch this in some way, but we got to get to Bob because he's the one that's going to write the check. I mean, that's a different, you would attack that differently than if you think, hey, I built a better mousetrap. I just have to let them know it exists.
Well, well said. And, I deal with people that have PhDs in engineering and other technical disciplines, and they have brain power that I don't have and know things I don't know. But it's different with every person, because some people have natural abilities and they get it fast. Other people don't want to learn and don't want to understand. But I need to educate people on what they don't know and what they need to know, and help educate them along the process on what are we about to do, why are we doing it, where have we been, and where will this next meeting take us, and what's the trajectory? And every company is different. I'm working with, I actually have a call tomorrow morning with a Fortune 50 company. One of the largest companies, it's a company that's been around for 140 years. If I gave you any more information, you would guess it, but it's a huge matrix company, multi-billion dollar company. And I have already had four meetings with four different groups. Each one of those groups has passed me off to another person that is getting me closer to the ultimate group that I need to talk with. But this is what happens in a matrix organization. And some of the people that I work with back in Israel understand this process. Others are frustrated that, why didn't that first person say yes? Well, I have to explain, that's not their role. But you can only learn so much from doing research and looking at somebody's LinkedIn profile unless you actually work at the company. You really don't understand the roles and, very importantly, the politics.
Right.
And so it's a journey.
Now, and that's the difference between the people who think I think that they can shortcut it through just being good at LinkedIn, maybe, and then actually doing the blocking and tackling that you're doing, is having the meetings, having the calls, getting the lay of the land. You know, the map is not the territory. You're learning really what goes on when you're having these multiple meetings and learning about kind of how that organization operates, so you can identify the person that can make the decision. Because the better mousetrap isn't always going to win, no matter how smart that technical guy is. There's plenty of cases where the best product isn't the one with the most sales.
I can give you a real example, and I can share this. Are you familiar with the streaming technology product Roku, R-U-K-U?
Sure.
R-O-K-U?
Yeah.
So they have different products from, dongles to set-top boxes, and they're actually making internal hardware for finished goods television companies, and they're co-branded, Sharp and Roku. And I interviewed for CMO.com by Adobe. I interviewed the CMO at Roku a month ago. The article will run in about a month or so. And the founder of Roku was also the founder. He was the founder. He came up with the intellectual property for the first DVR. But he ended up not winning. TiVo ended up winning that game. Why did TiVo end up winning that game? They didn't necessarily have a better product. They had better marketing. They were able to communicate what they did to consumers and to other intermediaries in the value chain, including content providers, than this gentleman, and I can't remember his name right now, but a serial inventor. And so when he came up with Roku, he then understood the importance of having a clear value proposition, of hiring a CMO that had the right experience in the broadcasting and entertainment and communication space to be able to communicate and position Roku better than any other product. And now they're number one. And these guys they're on a roll. And it's not just due to the technology. It's due to understanding what your brand's problem is that you're solving, what the solution is, clearly communicating that to various participants in your value chain. In this case, from the studios to hardware manufacturers to consumers.
Yeah, that's true. Now, who else do you, what companies do you see out there that are doing marketing that you're kind of going, oh, they're doing some cool stuff?
Oh, boy, that's a hard one. Throw some brands at me, Lee, and then we'll do it that way. Give me a brand that's top.
Well,
of mind.
We'll do a
quick analysis.
I don't want to get you in trouble, but how do you think Adobe's doing?
I think they're doing a great job, and I'll give you some proof points. Adobe originally started off as a software company for designers, but about a decade ago, they realized that we were going to be living in a data-based world. Graphics and visualization and design still would matter, but we were going to become more of a big data ecosystem, and they acquired Omniture. And so now the Adobe suite, as they built it or acquired companies, does both the science and the art part of what people in the marketing ecosystem do. And all of their products, by and large, interface in that suite. And it's become more difficult for a software manufacturer to sell a specific point solution because it's not part of a big suite. And this is why the big keep getting bigger, developing software solutions internally or doing that through acquisitions. And here's a proof point on why I think Adobe is doing a great job. Well, first of all, track their business results and their stock results. But from a very tangible standpoint, I've been fortunate enough to go to the last five Adobe summits that happen every year now in Las Vegas. This past year, they had over 12,000 attendees. It was mostly people from the technology side of the business, but they're also attracting CMOs and other marketers. The year before that, there were 10,000 people. The year before that, there were 7,500 people. So the level of participation at their annual conference, where they're showing what customers have accomplished, they're demonstrating existing products and teaching people how to use them, and they're also giving people a peek under the tent on what's in the labs, what could be coming next. The audience is growing. What that tells me in a very tangible way is they have a very engaged audience that is using their product, engaged with their product, and wants to learn even more to create beneficial results for their businesses.
Good stuff. Now, what about another company I'll throw at you? I'd like to hear your take on how you think they're doing, especially with the recent acquisition. How do you think Microsoft's doing, and how do you think the LinkedIn acquisition is impacting that?
I'll be honest with you. I don't study Microsoft, so I can't really give you a fact-based assessment. And I'm an Apple guy, so I don't use their product. But you know, I know that their new CEO has turned the culture and the company around. And their stock is a lagging indicator that the market recognizes that. I've also heard good things about their Surface product, that it's good. But I just think it's very difficult to it's going to be very difficult to catch up with where Apple is. And again, you know, full disclosure, I'm an Apple guy, so I already have preference there.
Now, what? How do you think, though, at like an acquisition of a LinkedIn, is that something that you think would be that can help them, and how they can leverage that and integrate their products and suite of services into that huge database now?
Well, I wasn't sitting in the room when they created the strategy to execute that acquisition, but I think owning LinkedIn gives them a treasure trove of big data individual down to the individual that could be used from a business development standpoint. You think about how any of us use LinkedIn. It's a place where you put your professional credentials down and you connect with others that you feel you need to connect with from a business standpoint. That can be a competitive set of insights that Microsoft has that their competitors don't have. In terms of making a site more user-friendly, I think LinkedIn has technologists and software engineers that have done a great job, and I'm a power user of LinkedIn and have been for years. But maybe there are capabilities and technologies at Microsoft that can be embedded into LinkedIn to make it an even better user experience, because the bar will continually be raised. I think they're going to use it as an advertising platform. Again, they have other brands advertising on LinkedIn, but Microsoft products can be advertised for no out-of-pocket cost on that platform. So you've got eyeballs that are potential buyers, both B2B and B2C users. So there's an advertising advantage there. Other than those three, I don't know anything more about the business strategy behind it.
Now, if you were a new CMO, do you have any advice that you would give a new CMO on kind of how to make the largest impact in the organization?
Yes, and I'm going to do analog first. Get to know people. Understand who they are. Understand what their motivations are. Understand what their scope is. Understand their interactions. And do that in your first 30 to 60 days, you've got to know people before you start diving in and second guessing why something is coming across your desk or why somebody is advocating something. I am a big believer in building relationships, and a Stephen Coveyism, seek to understand before seeking to be understood. As you do that, you can start to share your early hypothesis or thesis and get feedback from people. Make sure they understand this is early. It's changeable. But I wanted to get your reaction to it, and I'm going to get everybody's reaction to it. So use that as a way to start to test your hypothesis on what you've been asked to do by the CEO when you came in, or what your assumptions are coming into that new role, especially if you're from the outside. You really need to understand. And then I would develop a strong relationship with the C-suite. You need everybody on the C-suite to understand what you're going to be doing, as well as you obviously understanding what they do, and find out where you can add value. There, unfortunately, still are many in the C-suite that think of marketing and a CMO's role in a way that really dates their perceptions and understanding. They're going back and looking at marketers as internal service providers. And those days ended 10, 15 years ago. Marketers can be allies of virtually every C-suite member to help them do their jobs better, provide better information, provide better insights into the value chain, into prospects. CMOs need to be involved in all functions. You really need to be a jack of all trades. Now, that can be overwhelming. So you're constantly going to need to evaluate your priorities. The other thing that I would do, at least within the first 60 to 100 days, as you've got enough knowledge, is gain agreement with your boss, whether it's the CEO or CLO, and the C-suite. What are the metrics we're going to use to measure marketing's performance? Get clarity on that. And those may evolve over time, but get those first two or three down so you then, with your team, can reevaluate what are we working on? Are we achieving the objectives that we need to? And if not, what do we need to change strategically and tactically? I also think, and this is a long list, I also think CMOs need to start accomplishing early wins in the first several months. I always used to tell my teams, get points on the board early. They may not be the biggest things, but start to show results, even if they're early, of the influence and impact that you and your team are having on the metrics that matter. You've got to identify something that's important to the company, and then be very clear with the C-suite and the organization about the other programs and what the expected roadmap and timetables are to achieve programs. Unfortunately, I'm trying to think of the latest Spencer Stewart survey, but CMOs generally last in a job about 24 to 30 months. That's not a lot of time. And to do major disruptive transformative work could take several years. Most C-suites don't have patience for that. So you can show people what your long game is, but you've got to develop, execute, and capture the results for your short game.
Right. You got to work on both. Now we're talking.
Work on both.
Now we're talking with Stephen Cook. He is the CMO for Champion Capital Group and Startup Nation to Enterprise. Stephen, thank you so much for being part of the show today. If somebody wants to learn more about Champion or Startup Nation to Enterprise, what are the websites?
Well, championcapitalgroup.com, championcapitalgroup, no dashes, no dots, .com. We're a private equity firm in New York and Israel, and our investment thesis is all of the innovation that we need to focus on investment in is coming out of Israel. Startup Nation to Enterprise, that web address is www.s-nancy-i-intellect-p-property.co.il, based in Israel, sne-il.co.il, and you will see what we do with Israeli institutions and the IP that we can share publicly that we are now taking to market.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us for the Marketing Superhero Series. It has been an absolute delight having you on the show this afternoon.
Stone, Lee, thank you very much. My pleasure as always.
All right. Until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor, our guest today, Steve Cook, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.